ran out of the hut as if they expected the mountain to go golden in the night and all the waters of the lake to turn yellow right away. The captain of the guard came forward.
"And who are these?" he asked, pointing to Feely and Keely and Bilbo.
"The sons of my father's daughter," answered Thorin. "Feely and Keely of the race of Durin, and Mr. Baggins, who has travelled with us out of the west."
"If you come in peace, lay down your arms," said the captain.
"We have none," said Thorin.
And it was true enough. Their knives had been taken from them by the wood elves, and the great sword Orcrist too. Bilbo had his short sword, hidden as usual, but he said nothing about that.
"We have no need of weapons, or to turn at last to our own as spoken of old. Nor could we fight against so many. Take us to your master."
"He is at feast," said the captain.
"Then all the more reason for taking us to him,"
burst in Feely, who was getting impatient at these solemnities.
"We are worn and famished after our long road, and we have sick comrades. Now make haste, and let us have no more words, or your master may have something to say to you."
"Follow me, then," said the captain, and with six men about them, he led them over the bridge, through the gates, and into the marketplace of the town. This was a wide circle of quiet water, surrounded by the tall piles on which were built the greater houses, and by long wooden quays with many steps and ladders going down to the surface of the lake. From one great hall shone many lights, and there came the sound of many voices. They passed its doors and stood blinking in the light, looking at long tables filled with folk.
"I am Thorin, son of Thrain, son of Thror, king under the mountain. I return," cried Thorin in a loud voice from the door, before the captain could say anything.
All leapt to their feet. The master of the town sprang from his great chair. But none rose in greater surprise than the raft men of the elves who were sitting at the lower end of the hall. Pressing forward before the master's table, they cried,
"These are prisoners of our king that have escaped. Wandering vagabond dwarves that could not give any good account of themselves, sneaking through the woods and molesting our people."
"Is this true?" asked the master.
As a matter of fact, he thought it far more likely than the return of the king under the mountain, if any such person had ever existed.
"It is true that we were wrongfully waylaid by the elven king and imprisoned without cause as we journeyed back to our own land," answered Thorin. "But lock nor bar may hinder the homecoming spoken of old. Nor is this town in the wood elves' realm. I speak to the master of the town of the men of the lake, not to the raftmen of the king."
Then the master hesitated, and looked from one to the other. The elven king was very powerful in those parts, and the master wished for no enmity with him, nor did he think much of old songs, giving his mind to trade and tolls, to cargoes and gold, to which habit he owed his position. Others were of different mind, however, and quickly the matter was settled without him. The news had spread from the doors of the hall like fire through all the town. People were shouting inside the hall and outside it. The quays were thronged with hurrying feet. Some began to sing snatches of old songs concerning the return of the king under the mountain, that it was Thror's grandson, not Thror himself, that had come back did not bother them at all. Others took up the song, and it rolled loud and high over the lake.
"The king beneath the mountains, the king of carven stone, the lord of silver fountains, shall come into his own. His crown shall be upholden, his harp shall be restrung, his hall shall echo golden." to songs of yore sung. The woods shall wave on mountains and grass beneath the sun. His wealth shall flow in fountains, and the rivers golden run. The stream shall run in gladness, the lake shall shine and burn, and sorrow fail and sadness at the mountain king's return.
So they sang, or very like that, only there was a great deal more of it. And there was much shouting as well, as the music of harps and of fiddles mixed up with it. Indeed, such excitement had not been known in the town in the memory of the oldest grandfather. The wood elves themselves began to wonder greatly, and even to be afraid. They didn't know, of course, how Thorin had escaped, and they began to think their king might have made a serious mistake. As for the master, he saw there was nothing else for it but to obey the general clamour, for the moment at any rate, and to pretend to believe that Thorin was what he said. So he gave up to him his own great chair, and set Feely and Keely beside him in places of honour. Even Bilbo was given a seat at the high table, and no explanation of where he came in, no songs had alluded to him, even in the obscurest way, was asked for in the general bustle. Soon afterwards, the other dwarves were brought into the town amid scenes of astonishing enthusiasm. They were all doctored and fed and housed and pampered in the most delightful and satisfactory fashion. A large house was given up to Thorin and his company. Boats and rowers were put at their service, and crowds sat outside and sang songs all day, or cheered if any dwarf showed so much as his nose. Some of the songs were old ones, but some of them were quite new, and spoke confidently of the sudden death of the dragon, and of cargoes of rich presents coming down the river to Lake Town. These were inspired largely by the master, and it did not particularly please the dwarves, but in the meantime they were well contented, and they quickly grew fat and strong again. Indeed, within a week they were quite recovered, fitted out in fine cloth of their proper colours, with beards combed and trimmed, and proud steps. Thorin looked and walked as if his kingdom was already regained, and Smaug chopped up into little pieces. Then, as he had said, the dwarves' good feeling towards the little hobbit grew stronger every day. There were no more groans or grumbles. They drank his health, and they patted him on the back, and they made a great fuss of him, which was just as well, for he was not feeling particularly cheerful. He had not forgotten the look of the mountain, nor the thought of the dragon, and he had besides a shocking cold. For 3 days he sneezed and coughed, and he could not go out, and even after that his speeches at banquets were limited to,
"Thank you very much."
In the meanwhile the wood elves had gone back up the forest river with their cargoes, and there was great excitement in the king's palace. I have never heard what happened to the chief of the guards and the butler. Nothing, of course, was ever said about keys or barrels while the dwarves stayed in Lake Town, and Bilbo was careful never to become invisible. Still, I dare say, more was guessed than was known, though doubtless Mr. Baggins remained a bit of a mystery. In any case, the king knew now the dwarves' errand, or thought he did, and he said to himself, "Very well, we'll see. No treasure will come back through Mirkwood without my having something to say in the matter. But I expect they will all come to a bad end, and serve them right." He, at any rate, did not believe in dwarves fighting and killing dragons like Smaug, and he strongly suspected attempted burglary or something like it, which shows he was a wise elf, and wiser than the men of the town, though not quite right, as we shall see in the end. He sent out his spies about the shores of the lake, and as far northward towards the mountains as they would go, and waited. At the end of a fortnight, Thorin began to think of departure. While the enthusiasm still lasted in the town, was the time to get help. It would not do to let everything cool down with delay. So he spoke to the master and his counselors, and said that soon he and his company must go on towards the mountain. Then, for the first time, the master was surprised and a little frightened, and he wondered if Thorin was after all really a descendant of the old kings. He had never thought that the dwarves would actually dare to approach Smaug, but believed they were frauds who would sooner or later be discovered and be turned out. He was wrong. Thorin, of course, was really the grandson of the king under the mountain, and there is no knowing what a dwarf will not dare and do for revenge or the recovery of his own. But the master was not sorry at all to let them go. They were expensive to keep, and their arrival had turned things into a long holiday in which business was at a standstill. "Let them go and bother Smaug, and see how he welcomes them," he thought. "Certainly, O Thorin Thrain's son, Thror's son," was what he said. "You must claim your own. The hour is at hand, spoken of old. What help we can offer shall be yours, and we trust to your gratitude when your kingdom is regained." So one day, although autumn was now getting far on, and winds were cold, and leaves were falling fast, three large boats left Lake Town, laden with rowers, dwarves, Mr. Baggins, and many provisions. Horses and ponies had been sent round by circuitous paths to meet them at their appointed landing place. The master and his counselors bade them farewell from the great steps of the town hall that went down to the lake. People sang on the quays and out of windows. The white oars dipped and splashed, and off they went north up the lake on the last stage of their long journey. The only person thoroughly unhappy was Bilbo. Chapter 11. On the Doorstep. In 2 days going, they rode right up the long lake and passed out into the river running, and now they could all see the lonely mountain towering grim and tall before them. The stream was strong, and their going slow. At the end of the third day, some miles up the river, they drew into the left or western bank and disembarked. Here they were joined by the horses with other provisions and necessaries, and the ponies for their own use that had been sent to meet them. They packed what they could on the ponies, and the rest was made into a store under a tent. But none of the men of the town would stay with them, even for the night, so near the shadow of the mountain. "Not at any rate until the songs have come true," said they. It was easier to believe in the dragon, and less easy to believe in Thorin, in these wild parts. Indeed, their stores had no need of any guard, for all the land was desolate and empty. So their escort left them, making off swiftly down the river and the shoreward paths, although the night was already drawing on. They spent a cold and lonely night, and their spirits fell. The next day they set out again. Balin and Bilbo rode behind, each leading another pony heavily laden beside him. The others were some way ahead, picking out a slow road, for there were no paths. They made northwest, slanting away from the river running, and drawing ever nearer and nearer to a great spur of the mountain that was flung out southwards towards them. It was a weary journey, and a quiet and stealthy one. There was no laughter or song or sound of harps, and the pride and hopes which had stirred in their hearts at the singing of old songs by the lake died away to a plodding gloom. They knew that they were drawing near to the end of their journey, and that it might be a very horrible end. the land about them grew bleak and barren, though once, as Thorin told them, it had been green and fair. There was little grass, and before long there was neither bush nor tree, and only broken and blackened stumps to speak of ones long vanished. They were come to the desolation of the dragon, and they were come at the waning of the year. They reached the skirts of the mountain, all the same without meeting any danger or any sign of the dragon, other than the wilderness he had made about his lair. The mountain lay dark and silent before them, and even higher above them. They made their first camp on the western side of the great southern spur, which ended in a height called Ravenhill. On this there had been an old watchpost, but they dared not climb it yet. It was too exposed. Before setting out to search the western spurs of the mountain for the hidden door, on which all their hopes rested, Thorin sent out a scouting expedition to spy out the land to the south where the front gate stood. For this purpose he chose Balin and Fili and Kili, and with them went Bilbo. They marched under the grey and silent cliffs to the feet of Ravenhill. There the river, after winding a wide loop over the valley of Dale, turned from the mountain on its road to the lake, flowing swiftly and noisily. Its bank was bare and rocky, tall and steep above the stream, and gazing out from it over the narrow water, foaming and splashing among many boulders, they could see in the wide valley, shadowed by the mountain's arms, the grey ruins of ancient houses, towers, and walls.
"There lies all that is left of Dale," said Balin. "The mountain sides were green with woods, and all the sheltered valley rich and pleasant in the days when the bells rang in that town."
He looked both sad and grim as he said this. He had been one of Thorin's companions on the day the dragon came. They did not dare to follow the river much further towards the gate, but they went on beyond the end of the southern spur, until lying hidden behind a rock, they could look out and see the dark, cavernous opening in a great cliff wall between the arms of the mountain. Out of it the waters of the running river sprang, and out of it, too, there came a stream and a dark smoke. Nothing moved in the waste, save the vapour and the water, and every now and again a black and ominous crow. The only sound was the sound of the stony water, and every now and again the harsh croak of a bird. Balin shuddered.
"Let us return," he said. "We can do no good here, and I don't like these dark birds. They look like spies of evil."
"The dragon is still alive, and in the halls under the mountain, then? Or I imagine so from the smoke," said the hobbit.
"That does not prove it," said Balin, "though I don't doubt you're right. But he might be gone away some time, or he might be lying out on the mountain side keeping watch. And still I expect smokes and steams would come out of the gates. All the halls within must be filled with his foul reek."
With such gloomy thoughts, followed ever by croaking crows above them, they made their weary way back to the camp. Only in June they had been guests in the fair house of Elrond, and though autumn was now crawling towards winter, that pleasant time now seemed years ago. They were alone in the perilous waste, without hope of further help. They were at the end of their journey, but as far as ever, it seemed, from the end of their quest. None of them had much spirit left. Now, strange to say, Mr. Baggins had more than the others. He would often borrow Thorin's map and gaze at it, pondering over the runes and the message of the moon letters Elrond had read. It was he that made the dwarves begin the dangerous search on the western slopes for the secret door. They moved their camp then to a long valley, narrower than the great dale in the south where the gates of the river stood, and walled with lower spurs of the mountain. Two of these here thrust forward west from the main mass in long steep-sided ridges that fell ever downwards towards the plain. On this west